The classic definition of Zen, if we can speak in those terms, is that of Bodhidharma, attributed at least to Bodhidharma. Back around 500 in our era, beginning of the Tang Dynasty. And it goes like this, you all know it, but it is a direct, Zen is a teaching beyond words and letters, pointing directly to the heart mind of a human being. Nothing could be a simpler statement of the nature and activity of Zen. In the Tibetan tradition, there is a structure, an iconographic structure called a mandala. And the classic mandala represents, and we don't need to go into the details here, but represents what are called the five Jnani Buddhas. These are legendary or iconographic Buddhas who represent styles of being in the world, which can be either deriving from a deluded state, sometimes called a neurotic state, at worst a psychotic state, and each of which can be transformed into something that manifests the Dharma and is beyond limitation and suffering. For example, just to give you a couple of examples, the Jnani Buddha Ratnasambhava represents in the neurotic state and so on, the tendency of human beings to accumulate things, to solve something about life's problems, existential problems, by accumulating things, accumulating ideas, accumulating things, accumulating reputations, accumulating degrees, accumulating whatever. When that is transformed, it becomes giving. It becomes still related to things, entities, but they are now given to people appropriately to their circumstance. And it becomes a helpful process utilizing things. Another one is Amitabha. And Amitabha, in the neurotic, the Amitabha gate, as it were, or style in the neurotic state, represents lust, represents wanting to have, possess a person, to have this kind of relationship with a person that is mistaken for love. When it is transformed, it becomes love. It becomes cherishing. It becomes a relishing of the uniqueness of each person without this grasping quality. And thus it can confer blessing on all beings. And particularly because there is a validation of them through this individual's being, which is something that many people, maybe all people, crave, to have themselves recognized unconditionally. Another one is, just to mention one more, is akshobhya. And this represents the sharpness of mind. And in the neurotic state, it represents a style of being in the world where the mind is used to make all kinds of smart distinctions. And addiction to being able to think and, in fact, outthink and outquip other people. The transformation of that turns it into the adamantine mind, the sharpness of the Dharma mind that sees and is not fooled and is clear about the nature of things. And thus it can be functioning in a teaching mode without any ego attachment to it whatsoever, and nothing that is, that the style is used to enhance an illusory self. So, anyhow, these four styles, Amoka Siddhi, Akshobhya, Amitabha, and Ratnasambhava, are arranged in a circle. There are four entry gates in the circle, and in the center of the circle is the fifth Jnani Buddha's residence, which is Vairochana. Vairochana represents spaciousness, vast spaciousness. In the neurotic state of Vairochana, it is a state of kind of dullness, the kind of dullness that is, duh, I don't know, man, you know, this great kind of space, nothing distinguished, it's just undefined type of space. Whereas the transformation turns it into this vast spaciousness where all things can exist. And there is a transformative quality about this spaciousness. An absence of sleepiness and dullness that can go with the neurotic state of Vairochana and into an awake, spacious, embracing quality, where all things can exist. So, the significance of this is that this surrounding these four gates, there is a there is fire, and this represents the burning world, the world that is burning with desire, burning with ideas, burning with comparisons, judgments, conceptions about things that will not let them have peace. And from that burning world, one can enter these particular gates that are related to one's particular character structure. And one enters and goes in and encounters the transformed Vairochana. So gradually this process of entering into a silent spaciousness transforms all these qualities, which previously could have been narrow and hurtful to the individual and to others, and that is gradually transformed into its potential being, where the same capacities are used now in a way that can clarify and further the liberation of all beings, not to mind the individual themselves. And the way in which this is envisioned, this mandala represents a continual moving from that burning world into the world of ignorance and so on, into the Vairochana space, and then a re-emerging into this burning world, but now becoming more and more a transformative agent, more and more realizing that everything that exists in this world is has another side, has a transformed and side, and a side susceptible of transformation. And so it is a way at the mandala, that way represents having a gateway for all character traits. No matter what they are, there are no bad, there are no good. They're just what is. These bundles of styles that we manifest in the world. And there is a way of transforming each of those in order that it may become a benevolent force for oneself and in the world. So that's the teaching of the mandala. There's a lot of details about it, about how and all those sorts of things. But the idea being that one enters into this place. And that is, this begins a kind of a substantiation of the teaching of Bodhidharma when he said it is a place beyond words and letters that points directly to the heart-mind of a human being. Heart-mind means the core of a human being, the living core of a human being. Chinese character represents, is derived from an actual pictograph of the human heart. which is represented as the life-giving and life-sustaining core of a human being. So, one of the characteristics of this process of transformation and is depicted in the iconographic representational mandala is entering into spaciousness and silence. And that spaciousness and silence is the transformative, what will we say, the philosopher's stone. It's interesting that the alchemists had a wonderful statement that relates also to this. It was represented by the acronym vitriol, which of course was the old chemist's name for sulfuric acid. But vitriol means, and in Latin, it's veni interioriteri, rectificando in venia secultum lapidem, which translated means enter into the the center of the earth, or the interior, the center of the earth, and by purification discover the stone, the hidden stone, occultum lapidem. So enter into the center of the earth, and by purification discover the hidden stone. Now, in the alchemist's thinking, there was such a stone, and many understood it as being metaphoric. Foolish people actually set out on searches for a physical stone. But it represents a very similar thing to what the mandala, derived from Buddhism in Tibet, represents, and so many other places where people have seriously been drawn by a something of which they were aware that it exists. That is to say, the essence of faith, the proof of things unseen. Drawn by that and finding various vehicles whereby it may be uncovered in themselves. This is perhaps the most wonderful and marvelous transformative path that can be taken by a human being. Recognizing the vehicle and the qualities, the nature of our human being living in duality and all the corollaries that go with duality. Represented in Buddhism by the three poisons. And so on, all the consequences. And different people have envision this in different ways coming from their actual practice, coming from their reflection or their actual encountering and probing under and going down underneath into the interior of their earth. And certain ones have found the stone, as it were, the transformative vehicle. Much of this relates to silence. This silence, while it seems to have no dimension, this spaciousness, while it seems to be insubstantial, is actually the great transformative stone, the thing beyond which nothing, the thing that cannot be destroyed, the thing which, when encountered and interacting with one's being, no matter what your innate qualities and collection of tendencies may be, can be transformative. It is that which, sitting on our cushion, we encounter. And the way to encounter it is very much like the alchemic approach. It is entering in beyond all the differentiation and the tendency to differentiate and the tendency to classify all the differentiations and all those qualities of the discursive mind which, remember, are useful. The mandala does not represent the abolition of any quality, merely its transformation from a deluded state, a neurotic state, to a state of clarity and functionality without being based upon that which generates suffering. So all of us carry out the practice of Zazen, which is, in a sense, the unadorned, without toys, naked process of this encounter with that which is the transformative agent in all of us. This is what we're doing. So today I would like to read and comment on, very briefly, a group of, I think, five koan, all of which are taken from the collection called the Book of Equanimity. The first one is case number 7. And they all, many of these koan in different collections, begin with the word attention, which of course is central. You all remember Ikkyu's great admonition of attention. And asked for clarification to say a bit more about it, he said, attention, attention. And ask for still more clarification for we poor human beings who are unable to achieve such concentrated attention. He said, attention, attention, attention. So these koans begin, pay attention. For a long time, Yaksan had not ascended the high seat. The high seat was a seat that was in traditional Chinese Zen monasteries, was a seat that the master sat in order to give his discourses and to do Zazen. Some museums still have some of these high seats. I think the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston has one. It was wide enough so that the individual could sit in a lotus or cross-legged posture. The arms were wide enough for that. So, ascend to the high seat means to give a talk. So Yaksan had not ascended the high seat for a long time. The administrator monk spoke to him, saying, the monks have been wondering about some guidance for a long time. Your reverence, for the sake of the assembly, will you please give us a talk? So Yaksan had the gong struck, and the monks then assembled. Yaksan ascended the high seat, remained silent for a while, then got down and went back to his quarters. Later on, the administrator monk said to him, Master, a little while ago you agreed to give us a talk on behalf of the assembly. Why didn't you give us even a single word? Yaksan replied, there are sutra teachers for the sutras and instructors for the commentaries. Why do you come and bother this old monk? So when we read some of these things, it's important not to just take them as being quaint or something. Oh yes, silence is very important and all that. What a profound talk that was, you know. What if Richard gave a whole session and every tesho was silence? Be a little bit. Someone would probably go up to him and say, would you mind saying something? So we are to examine what kinds of silence are there. What is this silence? Now, one commentary says of Yaksan that he had shot arrows at many of the monks over many years, and none of them received a hit. In other words, people didn't get it. So many people will not get that sort of thing because they're so used to the transmission of some particular thing using words or some equivalent of words, a dance maybe, or a mime thing, or whatever it may be, some kind of overt expression other than total silence. And yet, the transformative function within our being finally comes from the cultivation of silence. So this was Yaksa. Now there are many kinds of silence, that is to say, if we have some conception of silence. And they all fall short of this ultimate silence. For example, there is the silence that comes, you might call it a monitored silence, with the real intentionality of quietening the mind. Anything that comes in, you kick it out, or you take some attitude towards it, and so on. And this is very useful. Very useful. Folks are not always able to leap right into the center of the earth. And so one needs to have means along the way. And these two are, these are styles. For example, you've all heard me say things like, consider the thoughts that come into the mind like the junk mail of the mind. They come into your consciousness, and so you get deluded by thinking that they are yours somehow. But it's just like junk mail. It comes to your mailbox. That is to say, the analogy in the being is that it comes from the ripening of causes and conditions and enters into your field of consciousness, but you didn't intend it. You didn't send your name in, please send me that catalog. You just receive it. Likewise, things come into the field of consciousness from the ripening, totally lawful and totally appropriate for all these causes and conditions, but basically they're none of your business. So I tell people, and I don't know how often it gets received benevolently, that whatever comes into your mind is none of your business. So we have means like that. We have means of, like, the road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom. Beautiful statement of William Blake, the poet. And so, one of the Zen masters said, if you can't throw it out, then carry it out. So, ruminate on these thoughts that come in. Notice them. Just go right into them and notice how they, all the associations, and just be pulled around by them totally for an hour or two until you get exhausted, very much like a person who was addicted to, let's say, cigarettes. And I used to do this with clients sometimes. I would say, you know, the thing to do, obviously it's an important thing to you about cigarettes, so what I want you to do is I want you to do something for me that you'll find will be very useful. And I want you to promise me that you will actually do it. And they finally wiggled and squirmed, and then finally said, I won't have to stand on my head or anything. No, it's just something you do ordinarily. Okay, I'll do it. Are you sure you'll do it? We make some real agreement. They say, okay, I want you to buy 10 packs of cigarettes. I want you to go into a closed room. I want you to smoke them one after the other without stopping. It was very effective. The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom. I guess we have to add sometimes. But anyhow, it's very useful, you know, to not do this thinking process in homeopathic doses, but to really plunge into it and notice finally it leads nowhere. It's just junk. It's just trash mind. And put that towards that life is precious and rare. Rarer still is the encounter with the Dharma, and rarer still than that is the opportunity to practice and have the Dharma exposed to you. And so somewhere, maybe deep, deep inside, it finally goes, okay, I got it. Yaksan's arrow would have struck. So monitor silence somewhere along the way may be useful. Silence in contrast to noise may be useful along the way. But the ultimate silence includes everything, including noise. There was a time, some of you know this, early on in my practice, I don't know how many decades ago, but anyhow, I used to go down to Times Square, and I don't know if it still exists in Times Square, but there used to be a pillar on which was a bust of George M. Cohan, who wrote, what was that, say, tell goodbye to Broadway, or hello to Broadway, or something. Anyhow, I used to sit beneath that, while, you know, the traffic was going by and all the people. The nice thing about New York is you can do anything that looks crazy and nobody cares, because that's New York for you, you know. So, but it was really a cultivation of my intention was to help myself to cultivate the silence that could contain and be in the midst of everything, including the rats that I used to see coming out at night, late at night, in the morning, and so on. So, here's another one. This is case 48 in the Book of Serenity. This is a famous story. It comes from the Vimalakirti Nirdesa Sutra. And the background of the story is that Vimalakirti was a disciple of the Buddha. And he was a wealthy man, had a big mansion and so on, and the word went to the Buddha and all the assembly of disciples and bodhisattvas and all that, that Vimalakirti was ill. He had a sickness. So the Buddha thought they should all go and visit him. And so all the Bodhisattvas, I forget how many there were, it's all legendary story, but 32 Bodhisattvas and 1,000 disciples all went to Vimalakirti's house. Vimalakirti, in order to prepare for them, cleared out the rooms so that everybody could be accommodated. And one of the people who came in after he was squeezed in as tight as sardines, as they say, and he's looking around, and Vimalakirti saw this, and he said, "Did you come for soft chairs, or did you come for the Dharma?" So anyhow, what got set up here was that Vimalakirti said, "Now that we're all here, let's everybody take a turn in saying what the essence of this path to awakening is." And so all the bodhisattvas took their turn and said what they think. Finally came to Manjushri's turn, and that's where this koan begins. So Vimalakirti asked Manjushri, "What about a bodhisattva entering the non-dual Dharma gate?" Manjushri replied, "As I understand it, with regard to all dharmas, there are no words or speech, no revelation or knowledge, and it is separate from all conversation. This is entering the non-dual Dharma gate." This is a good statement, right? No words, no revelation, no knowledge. It's all words and letters. That's what Bodhidharma pointed out later on, obviously, 1,000 years later. Pointed out as a direct pointing beyond words and letters. So this is what Manjushri said. Manjushri was last because he was the most esteemed of the bodhisattvas. And one, by the way, who manifested this clarity of mind that I spoke of earlier, that is iconographically represented by Akshobhya. So, anyhow, thereupon Manjushri questioned Vimalakirti, saying, "All of us bodhisattvas have each had our say. Venerable sir, now you should expound about a bodhisattva entering the non-dual Dharma gate." And Vimalakirti remained silent. This is sometimes referred to as the thundering silence of Vimalakirti. A silence of immense power. Not because he was tongue-tied, but because this thing was beyond definition, and as Bodhidharma 1,000 years later said, beyond words and letters. The next one I want to just briefly read is that it's case number one. And it goes like this. Attention. One day the world-honored one, is the designation of the Buddha, ascended the platform and took his seat. Manjushri struck the sounding post and said, "When you realize the Dharma King's Dharma, the Dharma King's Dharma is just as is." At that, the world-honored one descended from the platform. Third one, or the whatever it is, fourth one that I'd like to mention is about the way that action can represent this silence. And it portends that out of silence, the silence is not an a state in contrast with speaking or action. But it is rather the matrix or the ground from which liberated action and liberated words can come. And this is a famous koan that appears in many collections, and it appears here too in the Book of Serenity. And it's just given here in a much shorter form than it is in the Mumonkan, for example, and it goes like this. Attention! Zen Master Gute, whenever he was questioned, simply raised one finger. Gute, later on, shortly before his death, said, "I have used this one finger Zen all my life. I received it from my teacher, and I have never exhausted it." This silence, it is the fundamental ground of our being. That which sees, that which hears, that which speaks beyond monitoring, that which acts beyond monitoring. That is to say, without reference to a self, this unconditioned action, speaking, seeing, hearing. This is always different. For the universe, the world never comes to us the same. So this one finger of Gute was not just one more example of Gute raising one finger. No. It was in direct response to this circumstance, whatever the circumstance was. Everything is fresh, and it's such an extreme, this one finger. It gets us to question. What does it mean to be fresh and new? What kind of thing am I talking about when a person might say, "Oh, one more Monday, or one more tax form I have to fill out, or one more this, one more that." It gets a person to reflect on this. There ain't no one more anything. It's always new and fresh. But it is contaminated by our conceptions of things, and that's what makes it not new and not fresh. For us to be new and fresh, that is, rejuvenated, at each second, we need to find how to live from this silence. Even in the midst of the noisiest place, even in the midst of the busiest situation, Hakuin in his Song of Zazen says, "Our singing and dancing is the voice of the Dharma." Everywhere, everywhere. Raising this one finger is to let action come from this core of our being, at that center of the earth with, in contact with, and in fact identical with this philosopher's stone, this transformative thing which, without any intention, ensures that newness nourishes us at each moment. So finally, I want to read this one, this case 43. in the Book of Serenity, and it begins once again with attention. So, attention. Razan asked Ganto, how about when arising and vanishing are ceaseless? Razan maybe was concerned with something about going beyond and going beyond when arising and vanishing are ceaseless. So Ganto scolded and said, who is this arising and vanishing? First of all, everything that we deal with is a reflection of this self. When we get involved with these thoughts, they somehow are coming out of a self. A narrow self, a limited self. So Ganto asks, who is this arising and vanishing? What is this? Who is this? Almost to say, bring it forth. As the great masters of the beginning of the sequence that was begun by Bodhidharma, including Bodhidharma, saying to their student who was primed and ready, you say you are in bondage. Bring forth this self in bondage. I will release you. You say you can't break through. Bring forth this one who can't break through, and I will open the gate for you. It is all about this self. There's a wonderful quotation by Léon Blois that he wrote in the early part of the 1900s, strange to say, last century. And the end of the other one, I believe, I've forgotten now what his dates were. He's a very varied character. But there's one thing that I find wonderful that he wrote. And I'll say it in French, because that's what he wrote, Léon Blois, and then I will translate it for you. And he said, Dieu est le grand solitaire, qui ne parle que solitaire, et qui ne fait participer à sa puissance, sa sagesse, et sa félicité, que ceux qui participent en quelque manière à son éternelle solitude. He says, God is the eternal alone one, the solitary one, who speaks only to solitary ones. And who lets those participate in his power, his wisdom, his happiness. Felicity is a bit more than happiness. Felicité. Only those who participate in some manner in his eternal solitude. Now, this solitude has a lot to do with silence. It does not mean that we are physically out of contact with people, but it means that we are grounded in this place where we are sufficient, and this place of silence. Now, when he says God, he, of course, being Léon Blois, was rooted in the dualistic thinking about matter is spiritual. And it's quite understandable for an individual who encounters something of this realm, the realm of silence, the realm of beyond time and so on, as long as there is the, we might say, the contamination or the habit of thinking dualistically, to think in terms of being given a gift by a someone greater than and inconceivable by definition being God. And it's quite understandable. But basically this God is us ourselves. For there is only one reality. The gateway, the avenue, is through silence. This is the outcome of the practice of Zazen. A person has to go through many kinds of efforts in order to realize this solitude, this aloneness, this silence. But this aloneness is a very strange thing. For it is not alone in contrast to something. For being the end of duality, it is oneness. It is entry into the one and single reality that is so. It is natural, because people come from a dualistic background, that when they first encounter it, it seems like a marvelous awakening to a something. Very understandable. And it takes the training of Zen, the continued work in the way that Zen has designed this work, in order to really know that really it is one's fundamental nature. When you encounter this fundamental nature, it is a place where thoughts no longer are bound. They just don't take root. They are barely noticed, if at all. And not even the thought of imperfection has any place to take root. Moreover, it is a place of, I might say, love. But not love as directed by a self towards some object or some other. But a realization of the intimate, we might say, connection. But it really is identity with the discovery of who and what we are in intimate relationship to what we considered previously to be all things. And it is a place of certainty. How could there be any doubt, for there is only one reality? And it is a place of knowing that there is no beginning and ending. It is a place where all things exist, marvelously so. And a place where the self, as the Genja Koan puts it, has been forgotten. It's just an old story. Little piece of flotsam and jetsam that rolls away on the river. I would urge you to realize that this is your nature. But this is not something you have to fight and battle in order to find. It is rather that which will appear naturally as you learn through the diligent work of Zazen to drop away the habit. Of identifying with, you name it and fill in the blank. It requires faith. That is to say, it requires a recollection of what brought you to this work to start with. You knew somewhere in your being, through your experience, through your reading, through your inspiration, through some experiences that you had, that there was a something, we call it a something, that there was a mode of being in the world that was real. And that your encounter with Zen was the finding a way to access, to uncover, to expose that to you, to your consciousness. It's important to remember that and to serve that. For finally, there is only one work. There's only one work. Once you realize that there is something beyond the duality within which suffering and dissatisfaction arise. So I would urge you to do whatever is necessary in your unique, let's temporarily call it an island within this great fabric, this great web that has no weaver. Find your way. Utilize the helps and guidelines that can be offered to you, the experience of others. Find your way. And don't be fooled. Remember EQ. Remember, as starts all these koan, attention. 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 We'll end there today.